and the excluded communities.
And Amitabh, we have just 30 seconds. If you could say how humanitarian aid fits into it, the inadequacy of it, and what needs to be done.
It's extremely inadequate. It's fairly clear that the need for humanitarian aid is just growing. And that's growing because what we're looking at, you know, the poly crisis is also in terms of inequality, the climate crisis, conflicts, these are all coming together. And at this juncture, the humanitarian aid is galloping in terms of the need manyfold. But the commitments are very, very hollow.
So I'm afraid we're going to have really to leave it there. Amitabh Behar, Interim Executive Director of Oxfam International, speaking to us from Delhi. And that does it for its show.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, May 26th at 10 a.m. here on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, TriMet's planned fare hike sparks community pushback. Republican lawmakers across the U.S. say rollback of child labor laws are needed to address labor shortages. And organizers in Alabama resist voter suppression efforts. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 25th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Residents of the metro area will need $2.80 to ride buses and MAX lines starting in 2024. The TriMet board passed a fare hike yesterday on a vote of 6-1. Adult 2.5-hour tickets will see a 30-cent fare increase starting next year. Other ticket types will also see increases in price, including the Honored Citizen fare. It's the first time in over a decade that TriMet has raised its prices for riders. They say the loss in ridership since the pandemic hasn't rebounded, and the transit agency faces a deficit in 2026. Fares only make up about 7% of TriMet's overall budget. The majority is funded by an employer payroll tax in the region and by federal grants. The extra 30 cents a ticket is expected to add about $5 million in revenue. Protesters came out in force at the TriMet board meeting on Wednesday morning, eventually forcing the board to conduct their vote online. They say that this is the wrong way to increase revenue and ridership, and that it will primarily target low-income riders who pay the daily rates. The monthly and yearly passes are unaffected, but that can be a lot of money to spend up front for households that are strapped for cash. State Representative Can Pham represents Outer Southeast Portland and testified against the fare hike. Pham said, quote, "This fare increase appears to be a temporary budget band-aid that ultimately hides the larger systemic problems that TriMet must begin to tackle to be a transit agency in the 21st century. TriMet needs to move away from its reliance on fare revenue to close funding gaps and move towards thinking about transportation like an essential service and funding it accordingly," end quote. The fare increases will start January 1st, 2024. Lawmakers in several states are working to roll back child labor laws. Across the U.S., there are efforts to enact legislation that allows children to work in more hazardous occupations in expanded roles, including serving alcohol in bars and restaurants and longer hours on school nights. The new laws could apply to kids as young as 14. the efforts to roll back labor protections are largely being led by Republican lawmakers to address worker shortages. This puts them afoul of federal regulations. Lawmakers proposed loosening child labor laws in at least 10 states over the past 2 years, according to a report published by the Economic Policy Institute. Some bills have already become law. Under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, young children can only work until 7 p.m. during the school year. Congress passed the law in 1938 to stop children from being exposed to dangerous conditions and practices in mines, factories, farms, and street trades. Legislators in Wisconsin, Ohio, and Iowa are actively considering relaxing child labor laws to address worker shortages after a spike in retirement and deaths from COVID-19. Decreases in legal immigration have also contributed to the shortage. Teen workers are more likely to accept low pay and less likely to unionize or push for better working conditions. Teens are also easy targets for industries that rely on vulnerable populations such as immigrants and the formerly incarcerated to fill these hazardous positions. The Department of Labor reported in February that child labor violations had increased by nearly 70% since 2018. The agency is increasing enforcement and asking Congress to allow larger fines against violators. It fined a meatpacking sanitation contractor $1.5 million in February after investigators found the company illegally employed more than 100 children at locations in 8 states. The child workers cleaned bone saws and other dangerous equipment in meatpacking plants, often using hazardous chemicals. Business lobbyists, chambers of commerce, and well-funded conservative groups are backing the state bills. Arkansas Republican Representative Rebecca Burks said, quote, "There's no reason why anyone should have to get the government's permission to get a job. This is simply about eliminating the bureaucracy that's required and taking away the parent's decision about whether their child can work," end quote. Reed Mackey, director of the Child Labor Coalition, said of the changes, quote, "The consequences are potentially disastrous. You can't balance a perceived labor shortage on the backs of teen workers," end quote. Civic organizations in Alabama are pushing back against House Bill 209, which would criminalize any activity related to absentee ballots by people who aren't elected officials. This move will not only create hurdles for older adults and individuals with disabilities, but also hinder organizations that facilitate voting accessibility. The proposed legislation, which has passed in the Alabama House, could result in felony charges. Shantia Hudson reports.
Civic groups are taking action against what they call voter suppression tactics in the South. This week, Alabama Values, Solve, and Groundwork Project joined forces with other organizations to discuss recent legislation such as Alabama House Bill 209. The bill's provisions would forbid individuals from aiding in the distribution, ordering, requesting, collecting, obtaining, or delivering of an absentee ballot application or absentee ballot on behalf of someone else. During the briefing, Dylan Nettles with ACLU Alabama said the bill also criminalizes civic organizations and individuals wanting to assist others in exercising their right to vote by limiting who can help get the ballots or applications.
But that is a very narrow group of individuals. You essentially have to be someone who works as an election official or works in the absentee election manager's office. You have to be a next of kin of that individual or someone who lives with them.
If it passes, HB 209 would establish felony charges for people who break the law. According to Kiana Jackson, the research and coalition organizing manager at New Disabled South, this bill not only hinders organizations that facilitate voting accessibility, but also creates greater hurdles for older adults and individuals with disabilities.
We know that about 7.5% of disabled people are not able to have a voter ID compared to able-bodied people is at 4%. So there are a huge gap in even how we vote. But then particularly when we talk about accessibility and you're putting more and more barriers in place.
HB 209 is through the House and awaits action by the State Governmental Affairs Committee. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
A new law passed in Olympia automatically registers people who apply for an enhanced driver's license to vote. It's similar to Oregon's highly successful motor voter law. Lawmakers expect it will enable nearly 1 million eligible Washingtonians who currently are not signed up to cast ballots. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Washington Voting Justice Coalition.
Washingtonians will soon find it even easier to register to vote. Passed this session, Senate Bill 5112 automatically makes people applying for enhanced driver's licenses eligible to vote. Alex Alston with Washington Voting Justice Coalition says a number of communities in the state will benefit from this legislation.
We know that Black and brown communities and folks with socioeconomic barriers are often those who are left out of the system. And so moving towards a more automatic voter registration system is something that the state's been working towards.
While Washington has made it easy to vote in many respects, including with all-mail elections, lawmakers say nearly 1 million eligible Washingtonians are not registered. After registering them, the state will send a notice in the mail giving people the chance to opt out. The measure only applies automatic voter registration to people who prove their U.S. citizenship. Alston says this ensures people not eligible to vote are not inadvertently signed up.
We don't want inadvertent mistakes that would have negative immigration consequences for someone or their family.
Alaska, Colorado, Delaware, Massachusetts, Nevada, and Oregon have adopted similar automatic registration measures. It goes into effect on July 23rd. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declares his candidacy for president. A stalemate on the debt ceiling continues as the deadline nears, and President Biden marks 1 year since the Uvalde shooting. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Truth needs to be our foundation. Common sense can no longer be an uncommon virtue. And in Florida, we proved it could be done. We chose facts over fear, education over indoctrination, law and order over rioting and disorder. We held the line when freedom hung in the balance.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis officially declared his candidacy for president Wednesday, promising to take sharp action by constructing a wall at the southern border and not giving in to what he called woke ideologies. A morning consult poll found former President Donald Trump is still the GOP frontrunner with 58% support. DeSantis trails with 20% support, up from a mid-May poll. Meanwhile, congressional leaders returned to the White House to hammer out a deal to raise the debt ceiling before a possible default on June 1st. North Carolina Republican Greg Murphy is worried about a default and feels both sides of the negotiation have drawn their line in the sand.
Each side is saying, look, this is what we want to do. The White House is saying we want a clean debt ceiling, we want to raise things, and we want to raise taxes. The Republican side on the House is saying, look, we're willing to raise the debt ceiling, but there have to be spending cuts.
Though President Biden has indicated he won't be invoking the 14th Amendment to raise the debt ceiling, Connecticut Democrat John Larson feels it may be necessary. He noted Republicans and Democrats have come together before to raise the debt ceiling.
When you consider that we raised the debt ceiling three times in Donald Trump's 4 years, and then to again have Republicans take the country to the brink and hold the economy hostage, and therefore also holding people hostage.
Department of Education officials testified before a House subcommittee on President Biden's student loan debt forgiveness program. This week, the House of Representatives passed a joint resolution of disapproval to overturn the program. The bill now heads to the Senate. James Cavall with the Department of Education notes the growth of the U.S. student loan program and the debt it creates have erased the benefits of people going to college.
1 in 3 borrowers never graduates. They are left with debt, but no degree. Historically, more than 1 million borrowers default on their loans every year. And after a decade in repayment, typical Black borrowers owe more than they originally borrowed.
Wednesday marks a year since the shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. More than 600 mass shootings have occurred in the U.S. since then, according to the Gun Violence Archive. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to pass an assault weapons ban, a national red flag law, and numerous other gun safety measures. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Next week, trade negotiations resume between the European Union and the United States. And trade justice advocates are asking for a climate peace clause between nations. Suzanne Potter reports.
Next week, trade negotiations resume in Sweden between the U.S. and European Union, and advocates are urging all parties to sign a climate peace clause. In recent years, multiple nations, including the U.S., have used outdated trade agreements to try to stop other countries from favoring their own renewable energy sector. Ilana Solomon, a spokesperson for the nonprofit Trade Justice Education Fund, says these trade challenges are a major obstacle to ambitious climate policy and to a livable future.
In the context of a climate emergency where countries must be putting in place ambitious climate policies, it's madness to have governments using trade rules to threaten action on climate change.
Right now, several countries are threatening to challenge the electric vehicle tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S. and other climate policies in the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism in the EU. So far, no countries have committed to signing a climate peace clause. Thus far, courts have proclaimed climate policies from 8 states to be in violation of trade agreements. Solomon says governments need to form a pact to refrain from using dispute resolution mechanisms and trade and investment agreements to challenge other countries' climate policies.
The Trade Justice Education Fund will be delivering thousands of petitions from concerned members of the public who want to see the U.S. and the EU agree to a climate peace clause in the upcoming trade talks.
The Office of U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai did not respond to a request for comment. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7 o'clock, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be clear with some wind gusts up to 14 miles an hour. The low overnight will be 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny with a high of 83. Today in history, in 1953, the first public television station in the United States officially began broadcasting as KUHT from the campus of the University of Houston. The quote of the day is from American statesman Adlai Stevenson, who said, quote, "The free press is the mother of all our liberties and of our progress under liberty." The governor of Montana has vetoed state funding for policing on the Flathead Reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana Governor Greg Gianforte has vetoed a bill that would have funded Lake County's law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
The bill would have used state money to pay Lake County $5 million for providing law enforcement on the reservation. County officials have argued residents can no longer afford to pay for those services. Lake County, the state, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes entered into an agreement in the 1960s outlining that the county would provide law enforcement on the reservation. Lake County commissioners earlier this year withdrew from the agreement, saying that the state is responsible for picking up the work later this year. Gianforte wrote in his veto letter that when Lake County entered into the agreement, it, quote, agreed to bear the corresponding costs for the benefit of its residents, both tribal and non-tribal, unquote. Gianforte also said the state isn't responsible for funding law enforcement on the reservation and pointed out the county had opposed handing over law enforcement jurisdiction to CSKT in the past. Tribal officials did not respond to a request for comment by deadline. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
In Rapid City, Native leaders met with federal emergency response agencies, Bureau of Indian Affairs officials, and elected representatives to improve local disaster response strategies. This comes after storms froze South Dakota's reservations all winter. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more.
It was a winter sure to be remembered on the Rosebud Reservation near the South Dakota-Nebraska border, where infrastructure was tested by blizzard snowfall measured in the feet rather than the inches. South Dakota Senator Mike Brown spoke at the event. He says this is an opportunity to establish connections before emergencies like that happen again.
With regard to tribal trust land and land that's on the reservations, primary authority for law enforcement, for zoning and so forth, lies with the tribe. You want to make sure that you're communicating or coordinating with law enforcement. Well, if you talk about it in advance before you have the emergency, then those individuals know one another and they're better able to respond when they know each other and they know whose responsibility it is and they know where the resources are at.
He says while the federal government wants to help in these situations, there's an unavoidable sovereignty question.
We all recognize that there is a sovereignty among the tribes, but that sovereignty works fine until you need resources that the tribe does not have immediately on hand. And that's when you have to say, okay, we have different levels of government. How do we work together so that we can provide the immediate assistance to the people that expect us to be able to help them?
Frank Starr comes out as the president of the Oglala Sioux tribe. He says he appreciates seeing firsthand efforts.
The main thing is communication, the talks, and we're getting that out there. We're starting to organize, getting all these resources from different government agencies to come out to Indian country, meet with us personally, and to really take a look at how life is on our reservations.
Among other groups, the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association, FEMA, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs were present. For National Native News in Rapid City, I'm CJ Keen.
U.S. Senators Martin Heinrich, Ben Ray Lujan, Elizabeth Warren, and more than 20 of their colleagues have reintroduced the Truth and Healing Commission on Indian Boarding Schools Policies in the U.S. Act. The legislation was first introduced in 2020 by then-Congresswoman Deb Haaland. It was then reintroduced in 2021 by Representatives Sharice Davids and Tom Cole. The bill would establish a formal commission to investigate, document, and acknowledge the impacts of federal Indian boarding school policies on Native Americans. The commission would also develop recommendations for Congress for healing efforts and to provide a forum for the sharing of personal experiences. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In recent years, buying an electric vehicle or installing a rooftop solar panel might have seemed like an option only meant for residents and homeowners with sizable incomes. However, renewable energy experts say that is no longer the case, especially as federal rebates and tax credits come on board. Mike Moen reports from Wisconsin.
Clean energy products such as electric vehicles or home heat pump systems might seem out of reach for a lot of people. But with federal incentives and other support, more Wisconsinites, including low-income residents, could soon have easier access. Last year's Federal Inflation Reduction Act includes a mix of tax credits and rebates for products designed to make homes more energy efficient and save drivers some green if they want to buy an EV. Francisco Sayu of the group Renew Wisconsin says there's long been an exclusive tone tied to the renewable energy market. But he says the new incentives are a game changer.
If you're a renter, there are rebates and tax credits for equipment that you can take with you when you move.
One example is a portable window heat pump that can be used as an air conditioner. Sayu acknowledges implementation of the IRA is complex, meaning the rebates aren't available yet. Separately, the Department of Housing and Urban Development recently announced funding from the Act for owners of multifamily units serving low-income residents to seek grants and loans to improve the energy efficiency of their properties. As for electric vehicles, Sayu says there are now more options on the used market as some of the earlier models begin to age, and the federal incentives can be used for previously owned EVs.
If you purchase an electric vehicle that is priced below $25,000 and it's at least 2 years old, you qualify for 30% tax credit up to $4,000. And that makes electric vehicles pretty competitive with internal combustion cars.
Most states are awaiting guidance on how to phase in some of the rebates. Sayu says Wisconsin is in a good position because it already has a built-in statewide entity that carries out these types of programs. The state's Public Service Commission says that entity, called Focus on Energy, will directly offer IRA programs across Wisconsin once funding is made available. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
May is National Women's Health Month. Experts have some recommendations for women to make their health a priority and take the best steps to improve it. Danielle Smith has the details.
May is National Women's Health Month, and experts are reminding women to prioritize their health and well-being. Brenda Shelton Dunstan with the Philadelphia Black Women's Health Alliance says the worst of the pandemic showed that Black women's health was at the top of the curve as far as health disparities. She says her organization works to help improve health care outcomes and reduce disparities for women of color through awareness.
We provide education, increase knowledge. First, explain what a health disparity is. Health disparities are basically preventable differences in the burden of disease, injury, violence, or opportunities to achieve optimal health status.
Sheldon Dunstan says they provide strategies and approaches that can be used to prevent chronic conditions such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. She says the Office of Minority Health reports that per the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, African-American women are nearly 50% more likely to have high blood pressure compared with non-Hispanic white women. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warns that women who are caregivers are at greater risk for poor physical and mental health. Shelton Dunstan says it is important for women to focus on their mental health and to take time out for themselves while they are caring for their loved ones.
You have ultimate responsibility for you and for your self-care. How do you accomplish that? Making that a priority, making you a priority.
She adds their Primetime Sister Circle program helps women understand that they won't be able to take care of anyone else unless they take care of themselves first. Dr. Donna O'Shea, an OBGYN and Chief Medical Officer for Population Health at United Healthcare, says as younger women begin adulthood, it's important to take preventive steps so chronic health issues do not begin to take hold.
So it still is important to eat a balanced diet, and perhaps even more so to have a consistent strength and cardiovascular training routine that can also help minimize the stress. You know, as you know, stress hurts us in many ways.
O'Shea urges women to make appointments for any screenings they may have put off during COVID, such as mammograms or screenings for cervical or colon cancer. She adds, the good news is that colon cancer screenings is an excellent way to catch it early so that it can be treated and cured. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
This time of year is dedicated to promoting the health and safety of pets. Those who work in animal shelters say research is important in determining whether a dog or cat is right for you and your home. They also stress teaching their pets etiquette as more canines accompany their owners to public places. Mike Moen has more in South Dakota.
May is National Pet Month, and South Dakota residents considering adoption are urged to do careful planning while also making sure dogs can handle public settings if they tag along. The messaging comes amid a recent trend where more pet owners feel comfortable in bringing their dogs to places such as restaurants. That's brought attention to laws around the country dealing with such activity, and the Food and Drug Administration recently stated that pet dogs are fine in outdoor dining spaces. Madison Gottschalk of the Sioux Falls Area Humane Society says it's a good thing some businesses are now welcoming canines, but adds pet owners have to take on responsibility.
If you do get younger animal, you're going to have to put in so many hours to train it not to go in the bathroom inside, not to be aggressive towards food, not to be aggressive towards people.
Meanwhile, Gottschalk says it's important to plan out which type of animal is best suited for your lifestyle and home setting. That includes whether they're allowed by a landlord if you're renting. She says the Humane Society also offers guidance on how to introduce a new dog to another one that's already part of the household. And Gottschalk says budgeting for a pet is another part of the process. It goes beyond making sure they have enough food.
We make sure all of our animals, before they go out the door, are up to date on their vaccines, flea treatments, things like that. Those are all things that if you didn't adopt from us, you would have to spend your own personal money on.
Gottschalk says her location currently has a lot of pets available for adoption, especially dogs. She says there's enough variety to match a potential pet with an owner based on lifestyle, whether you like to go on adventures or prefer to hang out around the house. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 25th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and Michelle Coppola. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadov, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Danielle Smith, and Shantia Hudson. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for your Global Citizen International Digest with Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are today's subjects. Saving our environment can come at great cost to others. The latest on the consequences of global drought. War crimes and mercenaries in the Ukraine war. Elections in Turkey and Thailand. China's Central Asia diplomacy. China's youth problem. South Korea-Japan reconciliation. Iran's nuclear program. And the U.S. dollar sidetracked. As to the environment, thwarting climate change with energy-saving technologies requires mining certain minerals, whose production is exploding.